Good morning.
Good morning.
6 months ago, if I'd mentioned the word horizon to you, then probably you would think of a vanishing sliver of nothingness in the far distance that separates from the land from the sky. Well, nowadays, if the word horizon is mentioned, then there we are. For many of us, we're likely to think of a system designed to be perfect, but because of a whole series of vulnerabilities and imperfections, actually turned lies into truth and truth into lies. And as a result of this, people lost their reputations, were subject to public shame. Marriages were destroyed, families broke up, children's lives were scarred. Some people lost their homes, some people lost their jobs, some people lost their sanity. People were forced to pay out vast sums of money that they could not possibly afford. Some people went to prison. 4 people actually committed suicide. And that has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm going to be talking about today. But at another level, it's got everything to do with what I'm going to be talking about today. Now, the title of my talk is Food for the Stomach. But if anyone's come expecting some helpful dietary tips, I'm afraid you're going to be bitterly disappointed. And in the now venerable tradition of speakers wriggling out of their assigned topics, I need to warn you that this talk is going to be about a 3-letter word which begins with S, rhymes with Rex, and until the two very masterful presentations by David Robotham and Ian MacDonald in the last 2 weeks, we virtually never talk about in church. So it's a kind of a case of you wait a whole year for a bus and then 3 turn up at once. I better just start off with 3 little disclaimers. The first is this. It may seem that the person standing at the front occupies some degree of moral high ground, or at least has overcome the issues that they're talking about in their own life, or at very least has some degree of expertise in the subject they're talking about. And in this case, I'm afraid, none of those is true at all. In fact, if there was ever a case of there but for the grace of God go I, it would be me. So consequently, I have nothing valid to say on this subject at all. But before you all go home, I do know somebody who does. And what is more, he's provided us with a wonderful book full of case studies, full of examples of best practice, and some terrible examples of worst practice as well. So that's my first disclaimer. My second disclaimer is this. I appreciate that this is actually, for some of us, a very painful, difficult subject because of things we've been through in the past. And it's not an easy subject to deal with. So while I kind of stand here at the front sort of pontificating like a second-rate Mary Whitehouse tribute act, for those of you old enough to remember who she was, if I say anything that upsets you or offends you, please don't walk away in a huff at the end, but come to me and remonstrate with me at the end and so I can apologise to you in person. Third disclaimer, I only realized a few days ago it was actually Mother's Day. So if you come here expecting a nice, soft-hued, rose-tinted, uplifting, feel-good talk, this is absolutely none of those at all. So again, blanket apologies across the board. So now, having played all my three get-out-of-jail-free cards, we better go on to the passage in question. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 12 to 20, and here it is. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food. And God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For, as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined in the Lord, joined to the Lord, becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body. But the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. Now, I did promise there would be no dietary tips today. However, I could not resist including this. It concerns a certain Michel Lotito, sometimes nicknamed Monsieur Mange Tout, for reasons that will become obvious in a minute. Now, before I say this, it may seem that what I'm saying is a little bit implausible to the very least. I should say that this is actually verified by no less an august body as the Guinness Book of Records. So it has a reasonable degree of veracity behind it, improbable though it may seem. The other thing I should say is that the items being described were cut up into very small pieces over a period of time to be dealt with. You can see why that is important. Now, according to the Guinness Book of Records, the unfortunate Mr. Lotito, if I can get on to him, managed to consume during the course of his lifetime 45 door hinges, 18 bicycles, 15 shopping trolleys, 7 TV sets, 6 chandeliers, 2 beds, 1 pair of skis, 1 computer, 1 waterbed, 500 meters of steel chain, 1 coffin with handles, very important, okay, assorted razors and bolts, and wait for it now, a Cessna 150 light aircraft. And for this incredible array of objects that he managed to consume, he was awarded a Guinness Record bronze plaque, which he then proceeded to cut up and eat. Monsieur Lotito is said to have died at the age of 97 of what were described as natural causes. Now, I'm not a medical man, but I would just suggest that probably iron deficiency was not a contributory factor. And now here follows my unique and completely exclusive dietary tip, which is please don't try this at home. As Paul says, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. So on a more serious note, or slightly more serious note, why is it that Paul links up sort of culinary appetites with sexual appetites in this passage? Well, he's addressing Corinth, which, as we've heard before, was a port city and had a rather kind of sleazy reputation, a little bit like Portsmouth perhaps today. And sorry, okay, all right. You can come and tell me off at the end so I can make my grovelling apology. In that culture, as I'm afraid is true across much of our society today, sexual encounters were considered a bit like going out for a meal. It's something you could perhaps do without any special preparation or planning. It doesn't need any special context. You can do it just on the spur of the moment. Doesn't even need to be the same person each time. Perhaps it could be multiple partners. And in fact, if you look at some of our so-called celebrities today, it's not even a proper sit-down meal. It's more like a quick takeaway from the local fry-up. But that, of course, is a billion miles away from the biblical ideal of what sex is all about, which is an utterly sacred act that begets infinity. It is God's most incredible creation. And this passage very much draws attention to the fact that our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. And here is a picture of the temple and that curtain going into that most holy place. And there was only one person on the entire planet who could walk through that curtain into that secret hidden place. And that was God's most incredible plan. And if you look on the outside of the curtain, there are cherubim woven onto the outside. That was a huge no entry sign to the rest of the world to say, stay out. Because the cherubim, if you remember, were those who guarded the Garden of Eden. And the Garden of Eden being the place where Adam and Eve were naked together but felt no shame under God's original plan. And so that is God's perfect ideal for sexual intimacy. But of course, we know so much better today. That may explain why. Just interesting fact, between 1539 and 1857, there were only 300, that's a period of more than 300 years, there were only 317 divorces that took place in this country. Partly because you needed a special act of parliament to actually cause it to happen. Now, for most of the last 50 years, we've easily had more than 317 divorces every single day. So that is the difference that's the difference of the society we live in today. Since the Abortion Act of 1967, we have destroyed the lives of over 10 million children. That's basically the equivalent of the entire metropolitan area of Greater London. Just a vast, unimaginable number of people. In some inner city boroughs, cases of gonorrhea and syphilis are up 300% over the last 7 years. And then I just want us to think about some of the, there's all sorts of other things, statistics I could cite, but just want to talk about some of the violence we've done to our English language. So almost 100 years ago today, the guy called Aldous Huxley wrote a kind of rather dystopian view of the future called Brave New World. And one of the things in Brave New World is that the words mother and father would be considered in this society obscene words that you would never utter in polite conversation. Welcome to 2024, where AWE, one of our big local employers, where my dad worked till very recently, has supposed to have had one of the most enlightened HR departments in the country, has now decided that instead of using the word mothers, they're going to designate them as birth parents. So nice thought for Mother's Day. And dads are now referred to as secondary parents. So hope you're happy about that being sort of optional add-on there. The Brighton and Hove Hospital Trust has renamed its maternity department the perinatal department and now refers to chest milk instead of breast milk. And then what about this word love that we bendy about so much? According to the Beatles, all we need is love. But what does it actually mean? Our king famously said in his interview on his engagement to Princess Diana, what does being in love actually mean? And what does it actually mean? What does the phrase "I love chicken" mean? A vegan might come along and say it actually means you hate the poor miserable creatures so much that you're willing to have any number of them destroyed in order to satisfy your endless cravings. Didn't hear many amens to that one. Now, David Robotham will doubtless tell us that that's to do with some kind of weakness in Anglo-Saxon, and he could well be right. But I just want to tell you that even in the hallowed pages of the Old Testament, there's this double think about love, this is not the most uplifting passage to mention on Mother's Day, but I do think it is one of the most profound insights into the complete self-deception and delusion that is involved in kind of male predatory sexual activity. And I'm going to bring it up. And it is quite a shocking passage, but let's just get through it as quick as we can. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man, and he said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat from her hand." And then David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down. And she took dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, "Send out everyone from me." So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come, lie with me, my sister." She answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the outrageous fools in Israel. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up, go." But she said to him, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other you did to me." But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her." Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore, and she laid her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went. It's a really disturbing story. But why is it when this is probably the first time in popular culture ever in history that people have actually begun to call out these kind of predatory male sexual attitudes? And yet, why is it that Christian standards of morality are still viewed as almost kind of museum pieces, almost kind of Neanderthal in their backwardness? Can I suggest to you that it's because there's a supernatural dimension in sexual encounter, which we can so often miss? And that passage that's alluded to in our passage, "Do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For it, as it is written, the two will become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him." In addition to kind of random sexual behavior opening all sorts of biological doors, all sorts of emotional doors, it opens up spiritual doorways which are not necessarily easy to close. Let's just go back to first principles. In the beginning, God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on earth." And what I want us to take from this is that God gave us these two kingdom principles of multiplication and dominion. They were tied in very much with this creation of male and female. And when two come together within the covenant context of marriage as a man and a woman, then it is, as it were, as if when the image of God was divided up, as it were, in the act of creation, that it comes together and is fully expressed in that union. And that is a beautiful thing. But of course, Satan wants to steal that dominion and will do everything to try and undermine it. And that's why he wants to destroy marriage, destroy family, destroy the whole principle of gender. And you could say, well, that doesn't apply to me. I'm single. I would just suggest to you, you know, internally, we're all a kind of a family, because Paul says elsewhere, we're made up of body, soul, and spirit. And if Satan can just kind of cause all those things to be divided against each other, then he's already winning the battle. And so Paul alludes to this when he says, for I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members another law, waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Okay, I'm just going to very quickly sum up, so we're going to have to jump through some things. My question is, how do we stop this hostile takeover bid against against our marriages, against our families, against our own hearts? First important thing is, know your true identity in Christ. Everything flows out of that. We are children of God. You are surrounded by royalty here, children of the living God. That is your calling and your purpose. Secondly, clear out the rubbish. Take some time to do some spring cleaning. It's a time-consuming process. You may need somebody else to talk that through, to pray that through with you. Thirdly, we're just gonna jump through these. That's not enough in itself, because as Jesus says, if you just kind of clean up the whole place inside and do nothing else, then you're just going to end up in a worse state than the beginning. When the pure impure spirit comes out of a person, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to the house I left. When it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept clean and put in order. Then it goes away and takes with it seven spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that person is worse than the first. Okay. Repair the walls and install security. I'm jumping through at fast speed. We're not going to look at those passages. But basically, this is something that we need to do together. Confess your sins to each other. Actually be accountable to each other. Find someone you can talk to. If you can't find someone you can talk to, there are Christian helplines. The UCB prayer line, Premier Lifeline. It's important to be open with one another and share these issues, because what you bring out into the light really makes a difference. Rewire the electrics. So many houses catch fire every year because of faulty electrics. What do I mean by that? We need to redesign the way we think. Okay, this is Paul's later letter to Corinthians. We fight to capture every thought until it acknowledges the authority of Christ. Okay, I'm just going to rush through. These are some verses that are relevant to that. When we're talking about the eyes, we're talking about the whole way we see things, the whole way we think about things. And then the passages that we've come to recently. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's basically not saying gouge your own eye out, but rewire your electrics, okay? Install a fire escape. It's about fleeing from temptation. God will provide a way out. I'm just going to rush through to the end. There are several reactions we can give to this, which is saying it's too much for me. I can't do all this stuff. It's too much for me to handle. But listen, we need to do this. We need to take steps. to get our houses in order, because God is a holy God. He dwells in a holy people. He calls us to holiness. You may say, well, it's just too big for me. I cannot deal with this. I cannot handle this. I just want to end with a story that Reinhard Bonnker used to tell. And it's about a man who lived in a big house. And it was a beautiful house in the country, five rooms upstairs, five rooms downstairs. One day, Jesus came to knock at the door. And the man welcomed Jesus into his house. He was very thrilled to have him. And so he gave Jesus the best upstairs room with the ensuite and everything. And it was a beautiful room. And that night, Jesus went up to bed. There was a terrible knock on the door. It was the devil. And the man tried to shut the door, but the devil had his foot in the door and forced his way in before the man could shut it, and just inflicted the most sick, disgusting, appalling thoughts on him all night, just attacked him end to end. And then when daybreak came, he left and walked out. And so Jesus came down the next morning, and the man says to Jesus, "Where were you? Where were you?" And Jesus said, "Well, you've given me one room of your house, but the rest of the house is yours." And so the man says, "Well, okay, I'm going to give you all of my upstairs. Just take over every room upstairs." And then the same thing happens that night. Jesus goes up to bed. There's a terrible knock on the door. It's the devil. He forces his way in. And there's a terrible, terrible onslaught of thoughts and battles and the most appalling psychological torments. And the devil leaves in the morning. And Jesus comes down, and the man is very angry. He says, "Jesus, where were you?" And Jesus said, "Well, you've given me the upstairs of the house, but the rest of the house belongs to you." And then the man says, "Okay, I'm going to give you every room in my house, apart from the little room where I sleep. And it's got a few private things in there that you might not like. So I'll give you the rest of the house, and it's all yours." And that night, the same thing happens. Again, the devil knocks on the door. It's even worse this time. The most depraved, sick, unimaginable thoughts the man has to struggle with all night as he battles against the devil. And when morning dawns and the devil goes, the man cries out to Jesus and says, "Jesus! Jesus, I can't cope. Where are you in the middle of all this?" And Jesus says, "Well, okay, you've given me most of your house, but actually, the house is still in your name. The title deeds belong to you. And why don't you give me the title deeds of your house? Assign the ownership of the house over to me. And you can live in my house and be my guest." And so that's what the man does. He gives over the entire house to Jesus, gives him the title deeds and the keys. And that night, the devil comes again, and the man is trembling because he knows what's going to happen. But Jesus comes and answers the door, and he flings the door open this time, and the devil retreats back and is horrified and says, "I'm so sorry, sir. I must have come to the wrong house." And Jesus says, "Don't you ever dare come back here again. This is my house." Or there will be consequences. You are not your own. You are bought at a price.